the Future Proof podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you, as always, for downloading, rating, subscribing, exercising those thumbs and giving us that digital support. We feel it in our bones and tissues. Thank you. If you would like to contact us, you can do so. Email science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience, and we get to some of your emails and comments later on in the show. Coming up in this week's program, I'm going to be speaking to Rachel Sherman, and she's talking about the missing bit of the genome that isn't in the Human Genome Project, that lauded historical moment in time when we managed to map out the entire human genome. We missed a big chunk of it, apparently. I'll find out why later on. But first, it's time to have a look back at the week's science news. And joining me in studio to go through the headlines is Dr. Laura Dungan and Phil Smith, science broadcaster and educator. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
The only good bug is a dead bug.
We must meet the threat with our valor, our blood, indeed with our very lives. To ensure that human civilization, not insect, dominates this galaxy now and always.
So that's an interesting clip to choose.
Did you do a mashup? Was that two different movies?
It's Starship Troopers.
Yeah. It was two different movies, wasn't it?
No, different sections of the same film. So in that film, giant insects come and try and kill the human race, which is sort of like the opposite of what's happening. And and this is actually a really terrible story.
Yeah, this is, we talk about climate change a lot, and we obviously know that's incredibly dramatic and it's tied in hugely to this story. But this is one of those ones that you should run screaming. If you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, she's exaggerating, it's not that big a deal. It is potentially one of the single biggest deals in the entire world at the moment. And I'm not exaggerating. So at the moment, about if you take the human mass, if you weigh all the humans and you weigh all the insects, they're about 17 times heavier than we are. But currently, about 40% of those species are drastically, drastically reducing. And what we're seeing is they're reducing by 2.5% every year, which means that in theory, within 10 years, a quarter of all the insect mass on Earth could be gone. And within 100 years, they could all be gone. And this is 73 different studies that came together and they did a meta-analysis of it. So it is an amazing study. And it's really dramatic the way they even speak. I mean, scientific language in papers is usually quite bland. And in this, they are basically saying this is catastrophic levels of insect loss. In the paper, they're attributing it hugely to insecticides. That would be, they use these things called neonicotinoids, and they're kind of a new insecticide. It's been out in about the last 20 years, and it sterilizes everything. And it's not just the area that it's spread on. It sterilizes all the fields all around it, and insects cannot survive. So in Puerto Rico, 98% of the ground insects have disappeared in the last 35 years.
What?
98% of the ground insects in Puerto Rico are gone. Now, in Puerto Rico especially, and this is what they don't emphasize in the paper, it's hugely to do with climate change as well. So insects that are supposed to breed in a certain season can't breed in that season anymore because of the changes, but it's also to do with insecticides. So in Puerto Rico alone, 98% of the ground insects are gone in 2019.
That can't be right.
It's true. It's absolutely terrifying. I mean, the butterflies and moths, they've done, the UK has studied very well because it's, you know, there's a lot of universities in the UK. I think nearly 60% of butterfly and moth species are gone from the UK. The mass, not the species extinction, but the mass of the animals that are there. It's absolutely petrifying. And if we don't have insects, first of all, birds and fish can't eat, the ones that eat insects can't eat, and then we can't go on to eat them. But also we can't pollinate any of our crops. They're huge recyclers. I know bacteria recycle a lot of dead things, but insects do as well. Without insects, we die. That is a single solitary fact.
And
so we're terrified of climate change, but that might not kill us as fast as, which is also killing the insects. And
I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. Like that's
exactly
canned. That's just, we're not going to get any more of that.
Exactly. They? Gone. Like what would they, maybe they'd use snakes and scorpions, but what we can do is we can buy organic food. I know that it is more expensive, but it is the pesticides, the insecticides that are killing off all these insects, and also plant plant flowers and don't mow everything. People getting rid of all the little wildflowers is killing the bees. So there's huge, there was 6 million beehives in the USA about 30 years ago, and now there's about 3.5 million. So they've nearly halved in the amount. These are wild bee hives, or get your own beehive in your back garden. But this is catastrophic. I'm sorry to terrify everybody on a Saturday morning and ruin your weekend, but this needs to change now.
Do you know
today?
On this program, there has been sort of a steady increase in these sort of stories where sort of as a broadcaster looking back at the stories in the news, it behooves us to cover these stories.
Yeah.
And I am noticing that we're not having as many laughs as we used to.
Not as many fun stories anymore. I know.
Phil. The Opportunity rover is dead. Now, this is actually not that bad.
Oh, my God.
No, it's not that bad. It's only a machine.
Happy Saturday,
everybody. It's not only a machine.
No, let's celebrate the life.
Yeah, I don't
celebrate the Opportunity rover.
But, like, I used to name my colouring pencils, and when some little robot called Oppie dies, I'm also going to get emotional. I'm already scared. But this is a story of success. It is a story of success. So, Opportunity, which was a Mars exploration rover, it had a twin called Spirit, launched in 2003, landed on opposite sides of the planet, had a hugely successful life, but it's gone to sleep, as they would say.
No.
It was not. When NASA run these missions, they sort of have a very short window, it seems, sometimes, and then they say, "Look, this is what we have to do with this. If we do this mission failure, if we get more, great." And at least Opportunity had lots of opportunities.
Really, lots of opportunities. Yeah. So this mission was designed to last for about 90 sols, which is a Mars day. So that was what they had to get through. And it was going to travel.
How long is that in Earth days?
It's slightly a little bit longer than let me just check that to make sure. We're looking at slightly longer than Earth days. And I was talking to a friend of mine in ESA in Darmstadt. I was like, going, okay, so this is the critical time. It's supposed to last. What do you really expect it to last for? Is this amazing? He was like, no. Up to a year would have been out of this world amazing. Mm. Opportunity lasted for 5,353 sols, or about 15 Earth years in total, based on a 90-day. And that's about 55 times its lifespan. So to put that in context, Irish people on average live to about 81 years in age. That would mean that you would live to 4,488 years if you exceeded in the same way that Opportunity did. So good on Opportunity. And apart from that, it did so many other things. It travelled 46 kilometres with the distance between Dublin and Navan. It travels about 1 to 2 inches every hour in terms of speed. Its main mission and Spirit's mission, its twin, was to discover evidence of water on Mars. And it did it by finding gypsum, which is formed from mineral-rich water. It found hematite, another sign of Mars was wetter in the past. And it sent back amazing pictures of the Martian surface. So it did huge amounts. It saw the solar eclipse, all of these things. The real thing about this is now a dust storm has enveloped its solar panel, so it doesn't have the power to have the electric heaters that will keep it alive below the -40 limit,
which is actually amazing. We flung this thing so far, it took so long to get there, and then it lands and it actually stays working. I have so many things in my house that like after single use they just crapped up, and I'm just so annoyed. I don't want to throw them out, so they I've got these mechanical things that should have been designed better. Amazing feat of ingenuity and innovation. Yes. And exciting that we're entering an era of new space missions. I hear NASA are planning on doing stuff back on the moon. So our third story has to do with the pesticides, and this is not unrelated in some ways, but to your first story, Lara, and it's to do with certain types of weed killers.
Yeah, so I'm not sure exactly what I can and can't say, but there's a type of herbicide. So it's not, this isn't insects, this is for plants. And it blocks protein production in pretty much all plants. So it kills them. But what you do is you have a crop that's resistant to this herbicide, you spread it all over your field and only your crop grows, which seems great. Can I say the brand, the famous brand? It's true. I mean, the fact is that Monsanto produces a herbicide called Roundup, which is very famous, and it has glyphosate in it, which is this chemical. So that is the end of me mentioning them. From now on, I don't mention them. But what a new paper
it's
has
not
come
exactly
out.
How libel works. Just
I'm not sure. I'm really bad. Jonathan's one rule yesterday said to me is don't libel us. And I was like, I don't know how not to.
Well, just
I probably
tell
have
the fact.
In the past.
Stick with the facts.
Okay, well, the fact is that there are 9,000 lawsuits at the moment in the US claiming that this glyphosate herbicide has caused a type of cancer called non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And the EPA, the American Environmental Protection Agency, came out recently and said it doesn't. They said there's no link between it, or no believable link between it and cancer. And everyone kind of went, what? Like, it stops protein production in plants. I mean, purely that's okay. And now I'm getting into the libel territory and Jonathan's looking terrified. So this new study has shown that there is a 41% increased risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in people who have a high level of exposure to glyphosate herbicides. And one of the paper's publishers is one of the people who originally was in the EPA saying, you're wrong, EPA. And that she was sort of kicked out because she said, look, you're wrong. It definitely causes cancer. And now they've come out with this very compelling paper that says, look, it definitely does. This paper says it definitely does cause cancer. So it looks like glyphosate containing herbicides do actually cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
So increase the rates in human
41% increased risk if you are now, highly exposed.
So, yeah, okay. But how many people get non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in the general population?
It's fairly rare, but I mean, I don't know. I would say no more than 1%, definitely. It's a, you know, in terms of cancers, it's not like lung, you know, prostate, those kind of things are the very high up cancers.
But I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that it is tricky sometimes.
To associate these things.
Well, not, what I mean is because the numbers are not, if it was 20, you know, if it was a 5,000 fold increase, it'd be very easy to pin. It would be simple science to
do. Absolutely, yeah.
But actually, because the numbers are small, so in the case of if it was one person in 100, we're talking about one and a fourth of a person per 100 likelihood of getting this.
It is, and it's hard to assess how much people were exposed as well. It is a good paper, and there's a lot of research that's gone into it.
So, because there are probably people listening and saying, well, of course it does, then there are probably people who are thinking, well, that doesn't. What I don't want to seem is like I'm sitting on the fence. What I'm saying is that actually the reason why some extremely toxic substances last so long, and I'm not saying that refers to this, but the reason they last so long is because determining these things are extraordinarily difficult.
Absolutely.
Our final story, Phil, is to do with AI taking that next step. And I know I'm always fascinated by these incremental steps that AI is making. But there was, I don't know if it was hype or how this story was announced, but this took my eye. This story of AI from a organization backed by Elon Musk.
Yes, so this comes out of OpenAI, which is a research group backed by Elon Musk and Jessica Livingston, who are kind of the PayPal Illuminati. I don't know what you want to call them for.
before.
So it's an AI called GPT-2, and what it was designed to do was to write text like a human based on a prompt. And it turns out that it's pretty good at it, better than they expected, scarily better than they expected. And the way that it worked was that it was fed or trained 8 million web pages, and based on that it would infer what someone might say next or what might be the next word to come along based on a tone of the writing prompt. It's been given various prompts,
OpenAI, is that what it's called?
OpenAI is the name of the organization that and GP2 is the name of the AI. And it was given various things, so like it was told that scientists had found unicorns in the Andes, and it wrote two sentences and wrote a piece of prose about a page long. You can find it online, and it is scarily similar to what you would imagine someone to write. During my research, I kind of found out who had been tried this out, and actually The Guardian used it last Friday to write a piece in print in their paper.
So what they do is they feed the AI two lines,
yes,
and then they say, okay, based on those two lines, write me a believable full-page story.
Yes, and it works they're talking about 50% success rate. Like, it takes a number of times to get something, you go, yeah, that's right, okay, I believe that, in the tone that you'd imagine the person to write it or what you're exactly looking for. And like what I was saying about The Guardian is they used it, but they've decided to not to put it online because they're worried about what it actually might do, that it might go out to the public and people will start believe it and not believe it in context about what they were trying to do. Like the story of you eat spiders 8 a year, but you actually don't. It was just a fake story to get people to believe in all this. You don't actually eat spiders. So OpenAI, this research group, have decided not to release this GP2 in full because they believe it would be too dangerous because it can generate fake news so quickly based on a tone that it could do.
So that's why I find this story really interesting. Why make an AI when you're worried about the consequences of what it will do? And surely this is just a matter of time, because as a journalist, I'd love to think that
you know, when I write things down, I'm being incredibly prosaic and original. But actually, the truth is, people could probably, you know, bundle together a few, you know, a few shows of mine, figure out what I'm likely to say, and script something. I would say I'm ripe for being ripped off by AI, right?
Potentially, yeah.
So it's only a matter of time before this comes out. Why do you think this organization announced that they had done this, released it to some people, and then said, "Oh, but we're not going to publish it"? What's the point of that?
I think it is so that they can tackle it and actually figure out, because if this is going to work, that you have deep fakes out in the open in terms of the video technology. You need to be able to understand these things to be able to combat them, to be able to tackle them, to be able to decipher them, and then have an online robot war, I suppose, is the online time where AI is fighting to decipher what's real and what not. The underlying thing of all this is, if you have facts, if you have science that base up fact and evidence, you're able to prove if something is right or wrong. But often the public don't do this. They will read what's in the paper and take it as fact or take it on a particular opinion. So I think what they're doing with this is to show that this can be done, to maybe make people more critical, that they shouldn't believe what they read all of the time, and actually try and really use the skills within science and other things to decipher what's actually there.
Your thoughts on that, you can text us in 53106 for 30 cents. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. Phil Smith and Dr. Lara Duggan, thanks very much. Just on that story about neonicotinoids, Europe member states supported a near total ban of these in April last year. The rate of decline of insects, if you just missed it, that we heard from Lara is absolutely terrifying. And some of those figures just don't make any sense to me. Love to hear your thoughts on it. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. Now, in 2003, the Human Genome Project was this international research program whose goal was completing and mapping the entire human genome, and it represents one of the most ambitious collaborative scientific projects in recent times. But as the race to sequence the first human genome sped up, there were bits left out, and only now are we starting to figure out what that means. Joining me now is Rachel Sherman. She's a PhD student at Johns Hopkins Center for Computational Biology. Rachel, talk to us first, if you don't mind, about how the human genome was mapped for the first time. Who was RP11?
Yeah, absolutely. So when the Human Genome Project was kind of heating up, it became this race between the public effort and the private effort. And although the public effort had collected data from about 50 individuals, one of them, who we now call by their anonymized identifier, RP11, the samples were ready first. And so when they decided, you know, we really need to get a move on, we need to beat the private effort that's trying to sequence the genome as well and planning to patent it and not make it publicly available, the public effort took these samples from RP11 that they had ready before all of the other donors, and they sequenced those. And that's about 70% of the human genome that we now use today is from this one individual.
So in terms of genetic research, health and medicine research, we have this so-called reference genome. And that reference genome is what we consider to be the map of human DNA. And 70% came from an anonymous donor about which we know absolutely nothing.
Yeah, pretty much. We know a little bit. They were trying to find healthy individuals. So at least at the time, they were healthy. But, you know, that doesn't mean that they remained healthy later in life. And we actually now know that that individual, RP11, was African American. But this was actually found out much later from kind of post-analysis of the genome itself, since the individual was anonymized initially.
So that isn't necessarily the problem that it sounds, because people hearing that might think, but there are, you know, 7 billion people on the planet. How can 70% of what we call all human beings be just from one person? But actually, our genome, no matter what race we are, where we come from, our heritage, a huge amount of that is identical. Isn't that right? We're talking about the difference between me and it's the gene, the map itself is not what changes. It's the turning on and off, for the most part, that makes differences between human beings. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's certainly some differences at a genetic level, and even when the kind of Human Genome Project was being worked on had just been completed. They certainly knew there were some small differences at a genetic level, but yeah, the main reason, you know, you look different than I do and are a different person than me is due to things that the regulation that happens after to our genes after the, you know, post genome.
Yeah. So the things that when you say regulation, that's what I mean, the turning on and off, and that gives us different hair color and eye color and lots of different changes. So how do we then come to the opinion that we've missed bits of this genome? How is that something that we as the public didn't know, and how much of this human genome is missing, do you think?
So just for some context, the human genome is you know, a bunch of these bases, A, C, G, or T, these nucleotides. And a human has about 3 billion of those. So we've known since the Human Genome Project started that individuals have small differences, and some of those differences are, you know, additional bases. But this was kind of thought to happen on a much smaller scale. You know, maybe I have an extra couple of bases, you know, an A and a T in the genome somewhere where you don't. And it happens a few bases at a time. But what we're actually finding is that this happens at a much broader level. So my group looked at 910 individuals of African descent, and we looked at their genomes and collectively found 300 million bases of sequence that are not in this reference genome that we all use and compare to. So this is about 10% of the total reference genome that collectively we're seeing in these 900 or so individuals. So that's a huge amount of sequence that we're kind of missing from the reference when we compare to any of these individuals. Any one of them is going to have a good bit. Yeah.
It's enormous. So you're talking, you have these people who, for example, if you're looking for, you know, heritable diseases, or if you're looking for genetic markers for something, if it's in these areas, they literally don't exist on the Human Genome Project. There's nothing to reference them with. So where does that leave us in terms of our understanding of what this human genome contains?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a problem. And as you kind of alluded to just now, the way we do all of these analyses is we line things up to the reference genome. And so when things don't line up at all, we don't even see them, which is how we'd kind of missed all of this for so long. And we don't know what these pieces, maybe some of these pieces, the fact that they exist in some individuals is significant. Maybe it's not. Maybe you're totally healthy if you have this piece or if you don't have this piece. But maybe some of the people who have this, you know, missing piece, maybe something within there is causing some sort of disease, and you never would have been able to find it if you don't know that that piece is there to begin with.
And of course, that makes sense when you think about diseases, because diseases that have a genetic component are the ones that tend to be unusual because they are not passed on, right? In the case of many of those genetic diseases. So if they're not on the base, they are probably bigger targets for disease, right?
Yeah, I mean, they certainly could be. I think we don't quite know that yet.
Right, okay.
We don't know if some of these larger insertions and deletions, as we call them, these like large differences between, say, you and me, are necessarily more significant than the small ones. It's certainly seeming like it, because up until now, what geneticists have done is they've looked for these little single base differences, and we kind of thought when we had the human genome, we would solve all of these diseases that seem to have a genetic component, and we really haven't, and this could be a big reason why.
Okay, so we have a sort of a reference human being, and that human being has 3 billion base pairs, and 10% in just 900 people that you found, 10% of their DNA doesn't exist in this reference. So, I mean, does that really fundamentally change our understanding of how variable we are? I mean, is it possible that in just 900 of 7 billion, that actually the human genome is not as similar as we thought it was? I mean, is that possible? Or do we have enough data to say these are outliers, you know, these 900 people are not typical?
So I definitely don't think they're outliers. all of these individuals were of African descent, and we do know that African ancestry individuals tend to be a little more diverse than say if you look at a pool of European individuals. But I certainly do think this is representative. And we actually did some experiments where we said, well, what if you only look at 100? And what if you look at 200 from this pool? And does the kind of total sequence we find, does it keep increasing linearly, or does it seem to kind of taper off when we hit 900? Is that kind of it? And it's going to keep going. If we kept sequencing more people, we're going to keep finding more and more.
So is this useful to know? I mean, is this... Or does it make the question of using the genome as a sort of a reference more problematic when we think of, you know, diseases that aren't very straightforward? Because presumably the really straightforward genetically inherited disease, we've at least figured out those because they're so obvious. I'm thinking of CF, for example, Huntington's.
I mean, I think it really does call into question whether the reference genome, the single reference genome that we have, is the best model. And, you know, right now we don't know what a lot of these pieces we found do, but we feel like kind of almost the more important finding from what we've done is not these are the missing pieces we found. It's there's a lot of stuff missing, and we need to address that in the way we look at genomes and the way we look at genetic diseases. Perhaps by having different references for different populations, and you compare to the one closest to you or the many closest to you, if perhaps you're of kind of mixed descent. There are other options for how to kind of incorporate this missing sequence into our analyses, but we need to be doing that in some way that we're not doing right now.
So how has that gone down in the scientific community? Because obviously a lot of people's reputations have been attached to this enormous achievement of the human genome mapping. Has your paper come under criticism for overstating this gap, or how has the scientific community reacted to these mystery 10% of the human genome that don't appear?
I mean, on the whole, we've not really gotten much criticism. I think people were a bit surprised by this result, but we've been learning over the past years that there is kind of more variation than we thought there was. And we're certainly not saying that the reference genome hasn't been such a valuable resource since its creation. And we couldn't have done so much that we've done without it. But, you know, it's time to start thinking about the limitations of it as well. And I think most scientists realize that you know, it's always good to be pushing the boundaries and thinking about how we can improve things.
Is it possible to have a reference genome that a blueprint that is how to make a human being for everyone on the planet? Is it possible to do that if we see such diversity in just a small sample of individuals?
I think at this point, how we do that is one of the big open questions. If we're going to keep seeing so much new sequence as we sequence more individuals, if we were to say, look at somehow we could get the sequence of everyone on the planet, we wouldn't even begin to know what to do with it. We wouldn't know how to search it. We wouldn't know how to compare against it, because we just don't have the algorithms and the kind of the computational power and knowledge to even start to be able to do that at this point. So one of the big questions is really figuring out how we efficiently represent all of these sequences and compare against them when there's just so much out there.
Well, Rachel Sherman, PhD student at Johns Hopkins, thanks very much for joining us. I didn't say this on the on-air version because it seemed like bragging, but because you're a smaller, more dedicated group, I think you'll agree that this is okay to say to you. I was talking about the genome with Watson, one of the discoverers of the structure of human DNA. We were at the Cheltenham Science Festival, and I asked him, because it seemed to make no sense to me that over millions and millions of years of evolution that we would just have bits in our DNA that sort of just did nothing. It just didn't make any sense to me. And so I said to him on stage, he was on stage and I had a microphone, I said, do you think that, like, in the future we'll find some sort of use for this junk DNA, this DNA that people don't think has any purpose? Do you think it's possible that maybe we just don't understand it yet? And he looked at me square in the eye and in front of the entire auditorium went, no, I don't. And everyone laughed. And I, and almost like, you, what a stupid question. Well, the joke's on you, Mr. Watson. And you can take your Nobel Prize and all that. Anyway, I like that. I like that little moment of where, having had none of the expertise, I had a guess and a hunch, and it turns out I was right. Anyway, that happens once every billion times in the world. So anyway, look, that's my little story, because I think it's kind of interesting. We were talking about evil with Julia Shaw. She wrote a book. She is a criminal psychologist. And we were talking about empathy and psychopathy and or psychopathy, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And someone says, can you train empathy into a psychopathic brain? Well, Christian Kieses from the Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience actually did a study on this in 2013. And he looked at psychopathic criminals and found that psychopaths don't lack empathy, but they can switch it on at will. So they have a control over it that we don't. We have a sort of a natural empathy. He says the predominant notion had been that they're callous individuals, unable to feel emotions themselves and therefore unable to feel emotions in others. Our work shows it's not that simple. They don't lack empathy, but they have a switch to turn it on and off by default. It seems to be off. End quote. Another person says the whole nurture versus nature debate is always discussed in an either or manner, while it seems to be, as in most things, a combination of both. Life is always grey rather than black or white. Yes, indeed. But I suppose it is important to try and figure out the level of influence of nature if we're talking about, you know, behavior and free will. I mean, I think it's really important to examine what sort of percentage are we talking about when it comes to one's behavior. And you look at my 4-year-old and my 7-year-old, they're just very different people. And that's, I think they've been treated very similar. They've grown up in the same home. They've eaten the same food. They've gone on the same holidays. They've watched the same TV shows. So how much of that personality is from their environment? It seems to be there's quite a large part that's built in. We were also talking about endoterrestrials and like finding microbes in weird places like rocks. And Pat and Oramore, who Pat is a regular texter to the program. I met his wife, lovely lady, only a few weeks ago. She came up and introduced herself. She says, I'm Pat from Oramore's wife. That's what she actually said. But she was a lovely lady and you're a very lucky man, Pat. Pat says, when did the trend of saying that's a good question during any interview start? Not saying, of course, your questions aren't good. Thanks, Pat. But it just seems like an insincere habit that has developed recently. So I believe there are a few people who have. So my day job actually is not broadcasting on Future Proof. My day job is training people on how to communicate their ideas to the world. And so I work with CEOs or institutions or teams and I help them communicate their ideas, particularly if it's in science, med, tech or pharma. There's my pitch. And I believe there are PR people out there who are training people to say that's a good question. There is a couple of techniques for that. The first one is it buys you some time to think about a good answer. And there's other techniques I've heard other people say. So another one is if you ask someone a tricky question, ask me a tricky question, Simon, any question you want.
What's the purpose of meaning?
In what way?
In the broadest sense.
No, but tell me exactly what you mean by that. You see what I mean? It bought me 5 seconds to think of it. And there's other techniques. So if you have ever heard of Think on Your Feet, it's a course. And the course is like someone had an idea, they made some materials, and then they market the course to business professionals so that they can go, because every company wants to give corporate corporate development. So people in corporations often go on these upskilling courses, and some of them are really practical and some of them are to do with sort of skills. And one of the ones that's has been very successful is this Think on Your Feet course. And the idea is that if you were to ask me something like, what are your feelings on, for politicians, what are your feelings on, Brexit? You could say, well, I'm going to answer that in sort of three parts. I'm going to tell you a little bit about, what happened before Brexit, what's happening now, and what's going to happen in the future. And so you break it up into bits. And then by the time you said all that, you've probably thought of a reason, you can talk about something from before and something from the middle and some. So it just gives you an opportunity to be more fluid in your answers, as I was there. How was that for an answer? Is it good?
Oh, I'm enlightened.
I can tell you. Pat, to double back and answer your question, I think there's PR people who say that's a good question because it flatters the host and it makes us feel, oh, I'm pretty good at this. It gives them a good feeling and they like you more. So you bond with the interviewer if you do it sincerely. And then you have time to think about something else. So it's a kind-hearted thing. But if it starts to become empty, it's probably because someone's told them to say it and they're using it to buy time. My guess. Another says, maybe we will find the Rock Ness Monster. That's very good. Because we were looking for microbes in rocks. Very good. That's it for this week's Future Proof. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. There's more just right around the corner. That's how we do it now. We used to do it all in one big vomit of information, and now it's sort of dry heaving across the week. So you'll get more Future Proof Extra and Future Proof Gold before I see you next Saturday. Simon Keane was producing this week. Aidan McKelvey's series producer on sound was Peter Molloy. We will see you next Saturday for more of this. Don't you want more? In the meantime, stay curious.